Welcome to Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We are live tweeting this show right now. Join us at KUOW. The Trump administration says it's separating migrant parents from their children at the border because it's the law, it's humane, and it's in the Bible. We'll get to that. My team, my panel this week, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Hi, Joni.
Hi there.
Mike McGinn, former mayor of Seattle. Hi, Mike.
Glad to be here.
I have to call you mayor forever.
Mike. Yeah.
Hi, Mayor Mike. Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General. Hello, General.
His Honor.
Yeah, His
Joni.
Honor. Good to have you all.
Glad to be here.
This week, the city taxeth and the city taketh away. The same Seattle City Council that last month unanimously imposed an employee head tax on high-revenue businesses voted this week 7-2 to repeal the tax. At a public hearing this week, one of the head tax opponents, Phil Cochran, directed his frustration at City Councilor Mike O'Brien.
Councilmember O'Brien, about a month ago, you met some of us at your town hall meeting. We kind of felt like you weren't listening to us. You were deliberately ignoring us. Are you hearing us now? We got 45,000 signatures legitimately collected. Are you receiving us? Are you starting to hear us? Because we're fed up. We want you to start to enforce the law, close the campgrounds, and have some accountability for once. You guys have wasted hundreds of millions of dollars. We are done with it.
Mike McGinn, you ran a city. Is it fair to say on the head tax that the city council did not listen to its people?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is that the concern of people in neighborhoods with campgrounds and taxes is more important than concern about the fact that we have so many homeless people in the city.
The city council guilty of not listening to its people on this issue?
You have to ask, what's the job of the city council? 1 in 16 students in Seattle public schools is homeless. So what's the priority here in this job? Now, does that mean
overrule the people, or do you think that the people are more in favor of this head tax than this repeal campaign would suggest?
You know, clearly this is a moment in Seattle politics. There's no question about it, right? We've had a progressive turn of events for a number of years here, and what we're seeing now is a very powerful reaction to that. The politics of this are real. The public anger is real. What bothers me about this is that when we look at the problem with spending, you know, not in control or incompetent government, it's always programs for poor people that get exacting review. And that was my experience as mayor, too. I tried to increase money for the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, for returning felons, and the council wanted to see the data. Where's the data on a $1.9 billion convention center? Where's the data on a billion-dollar waterfront? Okay. Where's the data on $190 million for the Mariners? It's the things for poor people that get exacting review and that get the big referendum campaigns funded by the Chamber of Commerce, not the things that benefit the powerful.
Well, in fact, some of what is enraging some of these citizens who are mad at your very good friend Mike O'Brien and others has to do with things that should have been accounted for, like Move Seattle, the transportation levy of a few years ago that came in and promised all these things and can't deliver. I mean, I think what's going on here is that the sort of socialist happy hour is coming to an end here, because the city council this week, the mayor, the whole gang is the gang that can't shoot straight this week. Anybody else notice that? They can't get the politics right. They can't get the meetings right. They can't make this work. You know, this, I agree with you, Mike, on this point. This is a moment in Seattle politics where a lot of different emotions about a lot of different things, spending on homeless, spending on transportation, spending in general, and not seeing enough results is aggravating, angering people throughout the city.
I think that's right. And the part I've never understood is why the city council and the mayor didn't start with a plan for addressing homelessness. And that plan needs to be comprehensive. It needs to include expanding the supply of housing at market rate, expanding the supply of housing that's subsidized, expanding the supply of shelters and of drug treatment, et cetera, and then go out to the voters and say, here's a plan. It's based on experience, there's data to back it up, there's a timeline for it, here's a budget for it, and here's the additional money we need for it. Oh, and by the way, we're going to reprogram some existing funding to show you we agree this is a top priority in addition to asking for more revenue. I mean, that's, I mean, I did that when I was the budget chair at King County, and we needed a nickel per thousand property tax increase for parks. We went out and we had a plan, and we sold it, and it passed. I don't understand why I haven't done that.
Former mayor, what's your response?
Well, you know, we can talk about, you know, the tactics, the political tactics to sell a spending program. And again, that's certainly true. I managed to get a parks levy on the ballot with the help of the city council and help pass it. We did the families and ed levy. We did tons of work. There is a good way to do things and bad things.
But are those political tactics? He's
describing. Yeah, but there's no program, though. My point is they didn't have a program. It's not about tactics. It's about common sense public policy.
So
but again, I keep coming back to the same thing. Like, when was the civic debate about spending $1.9 billion on a convention center? That will close the bus tunnel, make it harder for people to commute to town. That is not given public debate because that's wired by the powers that be. Similarly, this $190 million for
the
Mariners is wired.
But here's the
why isn't money for poor people wired like that?
Here's the key. It was money first and how it would be spent second. And people seized on that because they realized that, you know, there was a lot of spending going on homelessness, but all they could see in their neighborhoods, in Mike O'Brien's neighborhood.
There was a difference between a lot and plenty of spending. This is Council Member Lisa Herbold addressing this argument that the city council is inefficient.
There's this idea out there that we've been just writing blank checks and not requiring any reporting on outcomes. That's not the case. People don't realize that more people are becoming homeless, even as we are moving other people out of homelessness.
Okay, so here's an important point for what she's saying there. So there was an attempt last year by this city council to go through and figure out which homeless service providers were efficient, and some were even cut. And what happened? They sold some property in February, and right back they restored some of that money. So even though there were attempts to show that they could be more efficient, they didn't do it. They get the first chance a property sale came in, boom, this money is going to more of this without explaining to people how they're being efficient.
Also, Mike, this idea, these counterexamples you're providing about the Mariners, the convention center, that just dodges the question. Have a program, have a plan. There is a plan for investing in M&O in Safeco Field. The hotel motel tax was increased for the purpose of that facility. Dow Constantine has pointed out that you would have to get the legislature to change the law to use that particular stream of money for something else. That's a sideshow. It's a red herring. Where is the plan to address the housing crisis, not just in Seattle, by the way? Where is the regional plan to address the housing crisis in our area? I don't see it.
Well, you're proving my point. Where's the regional plan? Where's the state plan on housing? We got a state plan for the Mariners. We have a state plan for a brilliant waterfront. We have a state plan for a convention center.
No, you have a
state. Where's the state plan for homelessness?
Where's the city plan? Don't you think the city should lead by example? The city's the one that wanted the head tax. Where is their plan?
The city is forced to lead because of the abdication of leadership from the state and the region. And they did try to lead by proposing a dedicated revenue source to build affordable housing.
So the answer is the city doesn't have to plan because they can't point to a state plan. That's ridiculous.
No, the city has to act because the state and the feds and the region won't act, just like we acted on 15, just like we acted on paid sick leave. And that's what the city was trying to do. But the same forces that hold back spending for housing at the state level and now at the federal level are ascendant in the city as well.
Funny you would bring up the $15 minimum wage because for all his faults, Mayor Ed Murray did know how to convene a task force, did know how to bring in all the stakeholders, did know how to say that we will sit here and work on this until we have, you know, enough buy-in to go ahead with this. Instead, what you have here is that you have this sort of government by bullhorn down at City Hall that didn't lead to a very solid package, and it led to
Mayor Durkin bargain down the size?
She did bargain down, but I'll tell you what, all of them misread this situation here. What you have are people who throughout the city who are angry about a variety of things. They see here comes the head tax. It's not that they're all madly in love with Amazon. That's not what's going on. It's that they're angry at the city council. Remember, a lot of people don't know. These are really new people down there at City Hall, generally speaking. So they don't have this fondness and this great name familiarity with some of these people. So when they make a mistake like this, there's not the love fell down. If you look at the polling, the support for the city council dropped 20 points over this. So that's the motivation for this week to then set up a screwed up set of meetings that are now what being
I what sued. I what I love about this debate is that both of you are zeroing in on the weaknesses of the pro side in trying to pass it, and obscuring the fact that the Chamber of Commerce, not the Chamber of Commerce, business interests raised a ton of money. They've been running anonymous Facebook ads attacking council members. There is a side that doesn't want this money, doesn't want to be taxed, would prefer that we stick with a regressive tax system. And there is a side that thinks that this spending is bad. We can just do it with existing spending. You know, and there is a side that's out there, like I said, with anonymous Facebook ads attacking council members.
Well, yeah, I saw the anonymous
Facebook are these, ads. So my question
is... 46,000 signatures made some noise here. Are people.
They absolutely did.
They're not hoodwinked, Mike.
But is the problem that we don't have money...
hoodwinked into it like has been
problem, stated? Is the problem with homeless spending that the left doesn't know how to organize itself? Or is the problem is that there are a whole bunch of people that don't want to pay taxes and have fought
that's
income taxes?
Well, here's the deal with Seattle. We usually sit here.
There are so many taxes in this city. That is absolutely counterfactual.
Well, a writer in The Stranger, the writer Charles Medetti wrote about this, the rise of a more conservative politics in Seattle. And Joni, you referred to a political moment in Seattle. Medetti writes about how American cities used to be dominated by a lefty coalition of immigrants, the black working class, and educated whites. And now in many cities, that's changing. And in Seattle, minorities and the poor are leaving the city limits, and you'll see more anti-taxers like Saul Spady, who helped lead the head tax repeal campaign.
I have a problem with how much the city is spending. Our budget's ballooned about $2 billion in the last 4 years, and I think there is a reasonable argument to say that the city could spend more effectively.
So how much is this tax backlash about liberal Seattleites finally being fed up with generously supporting taxes, and how much is pro-tax voters leaving town, and also anti-tax voters moving
in? Well, I don't know how much it has to do with the pro-tax folks being dominant here, but I think we usually sit here and we sort of chortle, you too, Mike, about how agreeable Seattle voters are, how willing they are to spend. At some point, we need to respect the fact that they may feel they said yes to everything, which is what they normally say yes to.
Okay, that was my question. Your answer is it is liberal Seattleites being fed up. Medetti's argument was that it's also about the changing demographics and money in Seattle.
Well, look, it's also about, I think it's more about people in Seattle who routinely vote for tax increases, including businesses that support progressive policies and tax increases, are saying, wait a minute, we actually want to see results. It doesn't matter if you're left, center, or right of center. Everyone despises wasted resources or ineffectively spent money. What this came down to was a lack of confidence, a loss of confidence in the city's ability to get results. And people are saying, show us the plan, build confidence for results, then come ask us to pay for it instead of just starting with the tax increase. That's what people are objecting to. Number two, as the individual who was chastising O'Brien was pointing out in the recording you played, people are sick of tent encampments on public rights of way. Remember, these are people who are camping there who do not want to be in the tent cities. They reject the tent cities because they don't want to be regulated in any way. They want to camp where they want, like those people who lived over by the Seattle Center and had the fire going with the grill out in front of the fire department was called because people saw the smoke. They said, we came here from the East Coast because we want autonomy. So people are fed up with folks living, wherever the heck they want to on property that we're all supposed to own in common. That's one of the objections. That's what this gentleman was raising, in addition to the lack of confidence in city policies.
Mike?
So on the demographic question, I think it's a good one, and I don't have the data, but I do think that's worth looking into. On the question of excessive spending, I actually do think Ed Murray, the chamber's candidate, ran the city budget into a ditch over 4 years. He didn't know how to manage, and there was excessive spending. I think it's right for people to be concerned about excessive spending. I was pretty fiscally conservative in office. But I keep coming back to the same point, which is what are we getting angry about? And we're getting angry about the things that help poor people. And the thing that about, this comment was there was no plan. There was a plan passed with the resolution. But again, this was given far deeper and more exacting scrutiny than multi-billion dollar projects throughout the city.
That's absolutely not the case.
Rob, you are going beyond the claims of government waste and ineffectiveness to also add in the pub. This is, I think, what you're saying, the public anger over the homeless encampments that
this
they
is,
see.
There are very few conservatives in Seattle. You don't hear people standing up and saying government in general is terrible. We shouldn't spend money on government. It's inherently ineffective and wasteful. They're pointing to this issue. And they're saying, not only are you spending more money, but you're not getting results. It seems to be getting worse. We don't see a plan to make it better. People are very focused on this issue. You can't sidetrack it by saying, oh, well, we didn't look at the convention center. We didn't look at that. This is not about helping the poor. It's about wanting to spend money in a way that actually does help the poor.
Yes,
People are fed up with not getting results.
And then you also raised the question of the frustration over unauthorized encampments.
Yeah.
So then that does raise the question over whether that's a legitimate frustration, how much autonomy and say these people have when they say that they don't want to go to shelters and don't want to go to authorized homeless encampments. Mike, do you think that public anger in Seattle is legitimate, illegitimate? What's your take?
I think public concern about wasted resources at city government is legitimate.
And we discussed that.
I think that there is, you know, in addition to not being able to manage a budget, Ed Murray didn't know how to manage his agencies either in terms of dealing with this.
But I'm asking about the public frustration
And I think the public frustration is with all of those things. There is a public frustration. But the city council tried to come in and fix what Ed Murray broke, and they're catching the blame for trying to come up with a solution.
That is pretty creative because you've got to realize this city is more flush than it's been in a very, very long time. They have a lot of money.
$1.3 billion more over 4 years.
They have the ability to spend lots of money, and they're still asking for more money.
Okay.
One of the reasons for the retreat here on the head tax is because they want to, in November, same ballot, ask for more money on education, and they didn't want a cloudy ballot. So that's they have plenty of money.
And the polling showed the head tax did not enjoy Maduro. It had 38% support before the city council voted on it. It's been plummeting since. They backed off because they thought they were going to lose at the ballot, not because a bunch of businesses like Amazon and Awajmai and others went out and got 45,000 signatures.
Okay, then final point. They thought
they were going to lose
and
at the ballot, and they were right.
Their favorability dropped 20 points.
Final point about polling. By the way, we talked a lot about money, and Mike, I gave you a path to talk about whether this public frustration is heartless or not, and we didn't get there. That'll be another discussion then. But on the topic of polling, I talked this week to the CEO of Redfin, Glenn Kelman, and he would have to pay this tax, his business, but he did not sign on to the repeal campaign. He said he thinks businesses should pay more taxes. He said the real key is upzoning single-family neighborhoods.
Any city spending will be a drop in the bucket if we don't build more housing.
So it's always hard to know to judge public opinion by polls. Last summer, KUOW and King 5 commissioned a poll of 900 residents. 48% supported rezoning parts of the city from single family to multifamily. 29% opposed that. Would that mean that it's time for apartment buildings in Magnolia, if that were what the polls said?
I support both. I support making it easier to build apartment buildings and backyard cottages and all sorts of varieties of housing. And I support taxing big corporations to fund affordable housing. Both are going to be needed to solve the problem. I think what a lot of people in the neighborhoods are going to find is that the downtown business community isn't going to come to their rescue when it's time for the upzones, because the downtown business community wants upzones. But they don't want to be taxed for affordable housing.
Robin, Joni, final thoughts on upzones?
So much on the upzones, but there is a responsibility, and I've written about it, and many people have written about it, on our big corporations to be involved in the homelessness problem. They do need to come up with solutions, you know, helpful. They need to be helpful. That's not their main business, but if you're part of this community, you should be contributing to the solution of our problems.
Yeah, I mean, so upzones are part of the solution. I mean, I'm in or near the central area a lot because of where I live in Seattle. And I'm seeing that effect. And there's a lot of housing going up on underutilized land. I'm talking about, you know, strip malls that are being replaced with retail at ground level housing above. increasing the overall housing supply with greater density is clearly part of it. I also agree with Mike that we need more publicly subsidized housing. There's no question. Remember, after World War II, we had a much worse homelessness problem than, or how I should say, housing shortage than we have now. And we responded in part by building a lot of public housing. That is also part of it.
And the head tax would have paid for affordable housing units. Do you have an alternative way to pay for that? Or do you think the government has enough money as it is?
I would,
like Saul Spady.
Here's what I would say. Start with the $1.3 billion of additional revenue they have built over the last 4 years, and then budget with that, and then look at additional, you know, potential additional sources. But it needs to, you know, it needs to start with a plan saying, here's what we're going to do, here's how it's going to help, and it needs to be across the board. I also think it needs to include more housing for people who are unsheltered. I mean, we used to have something called SROs. You know, remember that?
Yes.
Single room occupancy, right? Yeah. We need that again, something like that. Sometimes they're called micro apartments, but we need apartments that maybe it's one room, a studio, but people can get into for $500 a month. So we need to address this problem comprehensively. And yes, there does need to be a regional estate plan for sure, because we need to increase housing stock in the region, not just in Seattle.
We must pause it there, because we're going to talk about separating kids from parents at the border and culverts and the FBI and more. So stay tuned to The Week in Review as we continue with Rob McKenna, Mike McGinn, Joni Balter. It's KUOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter, Rob McKenna, Mike McGinn. I'm Bill Radke. The U.S. government is now officially separating children from families who seek asylum here by crossing the Mexico border illegally and not through the official checkpoints. Some of those detainees have been flown to a federal prison in SeaTac. U.S. Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Seattle met with some of the women being held there without their kids, and this is what she told KUOW.
In most cases, they were taken into a different room to, like, you know, here, come with us, we're going to take your photograph. And then after the photograph was taken, they were put in a different room from their child. So they never got to say goodbye. In some cases, they could hear their children screaming in the other room, screaming for their moms, asking for their moms. And they had to sit there and listen to that and still not be able to see them or hold them.
In defense of this policy, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions takes you to the New Testament.
Illegal entry into the United States is a crime. It should be, it must be, if you're going to have a legal system and have any limits whatsoever. Persons who violate the law of our nation are subject to prosecution. If you violate the law, you subject yourself to prosecution. And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government, because God has ordained the government for his purposes.
Any Christians here? Rob McKenna, hand is up. Taking kids from families, the Lord's work.
Yeah, well, clearly not, first of all. I find it very uncomfortable to hear the Attorney General of the United States citing the Bible as legal authority. It's certainly a source of moral authority. But can we start here just by talking about the concept of asylum?
Yeah.
All right, because I think it gets skipped over a lot, and it's just useful to remember. So we have a National Immigration Act that provides for asylum application, and the idea of the act is for people who can show that they have been persecuted for political reasons of politics, race, nationality, or if they're part, and this is the key part, if they're part of a persecuted social group. So what's been happening over the last decade is there's been a raging debate over whether or not women who are victims of domestic violence in places like Guatemala are part of a persecuted social group. And there's been back and forth on whether or not they should qualify for asylum. As a member of that, is that a defined group, or is that a group that someone made up just for the purpose of asylum? Sessions has come out with a revision that the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is part of the Department of Justice, has to follow now, saying, we're not going to recognize people who have suffered from gang violence and domestic violence as qualifying for asylum, because that's not what the idea of a persecuted social group was meant for. But that's debatable. I mean, others have disagreed. Janet Reno and some of her successors disagreed with that. So that's sort of the backdrop. The issue now, I want to provide just a little bit of perspective from law enforcement for just a second to put this in perspective. When people are arrested for crimes, their kids do not go to jail with them. They are separated. This is a tragic and a commonplace event every day in our judicial system. The counter argument to that, when we're talking about immigration involving the women that Congresswoman Jayapal was talking about, is that many people don't view these women or parents who've come across the border illegally as criminals. That's the heart of the debate. Sessions views them as lawbreakers. They've broken the law. And others say technically they may have come over without documentation, but they're not criminal, therefore they shouldn't be separated. It's a problem for people in law enforcement, including people in Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The detention centers are not set up for families. Jayapal and others have zeroed in on this tragedy, and others have countered that by saying, yeah, wait a minute. Why did these moms take the risk of coming into the country illegally when this is what happens? You get separated from your kids if you get caught. Secondly,
70%... But the Trump administration doesn't have to call it a crime to claim asylum in a way that the administration doesn't recognize, right?
They could just as easily
not
do this. They could just as easily... I know they're trying to send a message.
No,
they love the pictures going out because supposedly that's the deterrent to this happening. They could do that. But, I mean, this is not what America is and wants to look like. You know that, right?
I agree with that. I actually agree. I think that there should be a method of keeping families together while they're awaiting their asylum hearing. I agree with that. I don't think this is the humane thing to do. I'm just trying to explain the perspective of federal immigration enforcement and law enforcement and put it in that broader context.
So they must be fleeing something worth taking this risk, and that's what they're saying. But what Representative Jayapal was telling everybody, these folks never got a chance to really explain their own individual story. They were processed in groups of 50 or 100.
Yeah, but
how do you explain what you were fleeing?
But,
I mean, you wouldn't just go to the border where you're going to be detained and your kids are going to be separated from you if you didn't have a fairly decent reason. So
and
let's
hear
the reason.
There is a process for that, though. I mean, there is a process. There is an administrative process. My firm, for example, many law firms and many lawyers devote considerable effort and energy and resources to pro bono cases where we're representing them. We have a case in my office right now involving three kids from Mexico who we're helping to stay in the country, we hope. It's in process. And so there is a specific process. One of the problems, though, is that many of these children who are individually here, and 70%, I just heard a story on NPR this morning, that 70% of the kids in a particular detention center, or, you know, whose parents are in detention, came over by themselves. 70% of the kids who are being taken care of came over without their parents. These are children under the age of 18. So raises the question, why are people taking the risk of sending their children alone into the country illegally?
Well, on the question of the enforcement of the law, I'm trying to figure out whether the Trump administration is portraying it as them not having a choice. The White House spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, told CNN's Jim Acosta why the administration's doing this.
Because it's the law, and that's what the law states.
You guys don't have to do that.
It doesn't have to be the law, and the president has actually called on Democrats in Congress to fix those loopholes. The Democrats have failed to come to the table, failed to help this president close these loopholes and fix this problem.
Help the president. So was the Obama administration not complying with the law when it treated illegal crossings as civil matters and keeping detained families together?
Were they keeping detained families together systematically in the Obama administration?
Well, I don't know.
I'm asking because I don't know. I mean, we're hearing all about this all very recently, but is this a change in policy to separate children from their parents when the parents are detained by immigration authorities? Because that is the practice in law enforcement generally, and I don't know what's been done historically.
My understanding is this enforcement as a criminal matter and then separating the parents from children is as of April. That's my understanding.
But this has gotten so big. You have kids in a Walmart, in a giant Walmart, a bunch of Pokemon posters on the wall, and you're entertaining them with movies. This is unwinnable as an image for either for the Republicans or the Democrats.
Yes, Mike.
Clearly, the president has discretion as an executive to choose to keep families together. And if somebody wanted to bring a lawsuit telling them to separate people because that's the law, let them bring it. Right. This is part of what executives do, and this is part of what prosecutors and attorney generals do, is exercise discretion all the time. The question is, what we're seeing with Trump is that he's prioritizing the views of his base, who are concerned about illegal immigrants taking jobs, and not prioritizing the concerns of these families and children that are being separated. By the way, I'm really glad to hear that both Joni and Rob are going there, because it was very interesting in the head tax debate. We were prioritizing the concerns of people angry about homeless encampments.
You keep trying to draw these sharp lines.
Please, not prioritizing the concerns of those that are on the street homeless. 1 in 16 children in Seattle public schools are homeless. We didn't talk about that in that entire segment. This is what local commentator Brett Hamill calls the inverse proximity law of Seattle politics. The further away it is, the more progressive we get.
No, what we were talking about was the lack of an actual plan to deal with the 1 in 16.
And we have talked about that, so I must pause that. just a quick answer then, Rob. Your successor as Washington Attorney General is said to be considering a lawsuit. Do you think Washington State has standing to sue the Trump administration for the separating kids and families?
Standing isn't that hard for a state to prove. They'll find some local angle, some impact on state resources. They'll establish standing. Whether or not they have a cause of action is a different matter.
Okay.
This is a matter of law and policy, and it would be more humane and wiser in the long term to keep moms and their kids together while the mom's asylum petitions are pending, and until that decision is made. If they're granted asylum, they come in with their kids and they've been with their kids the whole time. If they're not granted asylum, they go back to the country they came from with their kids. But separating them doesn't make a lot of sense to me, as a starting point.
Okay, this is The Week in Review with Rob McKenna, and I'm having trouble separating my emotions, keeping my emotions out of this, but I'm trying. Rob McKenna, Mike McGinn, Joni Balter will be right back with The Week in Review. Okay, The Week in Review continuing now. This week, Washington State's government lost a big case at the U.S. Supreme Court, and Washington tribes won, in effect. This is the Washington versus United States, and the court deadlocked, which means a lower court ruling stands, which means Washington State has to pay to restore salmon habitat, which means replacing hundreds of those pipes that you see underneath roads. They're called culverts. And they're there to allow streams to keep flowing under those roads, and they're really hard for salmon to swim through. This is the chair of the Suquamish tribe, Leonard Forsman, describing in 2015 how these culverts affect his tribe.
It's threatened our culture by the fact that our younger generation isn't have the same opportunities that maybe past generations have had to fish together as families and to be able to contribute to the cultural strength of their communities by providing for ceremonies, funerals, weddings, and for family consumption.
Former Attorney General Rob McKenna, this court ruling is expensive for Washington State, but is it wrong?
It's not wrong in terms of the state's obligation to replace culverts. And as I've said before on the show, mm-hmm. this is a case that dates back over 5 state AGs, including the incumbent. The state has been replacing its culverts. When this case started, there was an issue with culverts under roads owned by the Department of Natural Resources or Fish and Wildlife. Those have basically all been replaced. What's remaining are a large number of culverts under state highways. And the state estimates it'll cost about $1.9 billion to replace those. The debate has been over how fast they will be replaced. The district court, the federal district court, ordered that they be replaced. The high priority culverts would be replaced over 17 years. The state was saying, that's faster than we think we can afford. But that's frankly a budget and technical debate. The real issue in this case that the tribes have been pursuing since the early 1980s in a prior version of this case, and succeeded in securing in the Ninth Circuit ruling, is the idea that not only are they entitled to a fair share of the fish, 50%, and access to catch the fish, they're also guaranteed a supply of fish that allows them to have a, quote, moderate living, to make a moderate living from fishing in perpetuity. And that's not even the biggest part of this. The biggest part of this is the implication that the tribes are asserting that means that they can be co-sovereign with state and local governments in over any decision that can be shown to have some impact on fish. That means land use, water rights.
Yeah.
It's huge. So the reason the state has been appealing this And the issue that the Supreme Court did not reach because they split 4-4 with Justice Kennedy recusing himself is that we need to find a balance point. I agree with the tribes that their forebears never would have signed on to these treaties if they thought the treaties meant that, you can have access to the fish, but we can destroy the fish runs. They never would have signed up for that. They're absolutely right about that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think it's true that the U.S. government, Governor Stevens, who negotiated these, didn't think that they were signing up for a treaty, agreing to a treaty that made the tribes co-sovereign over all decisions that
did
could
the court
them.
Use the term co-sovereign?
No, that's the concept that's been used for many years, though, because it's the technical term is an environmental servitude. All that means is the fish come first in every circumstance.
Okay.
So the Supreme Court is going to have to come back to that question and find that balance point somewhere between an environmental servitude being established that runs with the land over all decisions so that fish are always first, and the other extreme, which is the state can destroy the fish runs if they want. Somewhere in that gap, there's a balance point that the Supreme Court's going to have to establish.
Okay.
They didn't get to that.
But they are saying that the habitat is very important, that they didn't only get half the harvestable salmon and the Bolt decision and all of that, but that they had to have habitat that would give us some of the salmon.
Give
the tribe some of the salmon. Yeah. So that was important. I had a question for you, Rob, and that was, the state... The state could have settled this. They had so many different opportunities. Is there a reason? Because there was a risk before the court, a big one.
There was a reason that it didn't settle. It's because it's never really been about the number of culverts, how fast they'll be replaced, et cetera. The tribes want the legal principle that they, I'm using the word co-sovereign, what my colleagues have used it, but they want that environmental servitude. They want to be able to point to any land use decision,
what would
any
be an
water
example?
Rights decision.
What would be an example of a issue, a land use or water rights issue, that this ruling would give the tribes more power over?
An example would be the availability of permits for wells. In rural areas that depend on well water, where the well water is connected hydrologically to neighboring streams, and taking the water out of the wells could reduce the amount of water in the stream, which could affect the number of fish. Keep in mind, I think everyone listening to this knows, we have very strong environmental laws in this state. We have elaborate processes to protect environmental values. But notwithstanding all of that, there are fewer fish now than there were when the treaties were signed. No one conceived of the idea in the 1850s that there wouldn't be a superabundance of fish 100, 150 years later. But that's where we find ourselves.
And these culverts, for everyone who doesn't know, can make it hard for salmon to get through the stream.
They can make it impossible.
Make it impossible.
Yeah. They should
block
be,
can.
They should and will be replaced.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mike, anything to add before we move on?
Yeah, but just a brief thought. The tribes made a deal. The deal has to be honored.
Yes.
And the culvert decision is right. The tribes keep winning these cases against that their treaty rights mean something. We like to talk about a maintenance backlog a lot. We think about streets and highways and things. But what we've done to environment, we got a big backlog of work to do to repair the environment. And that needs to be a priority. And thank God that we have some treaty rights and the Native Americans are doing and enforcing something that shouldn't have to be a lawsuit.
And so it's interesting to me. I wonder, how incredibly expensive this is going to be. You mentioned $2 billion. I've heard much higher than that. How we go about that, because the state obviously is going to argue that, some of the design for the culverts came from the federal government.
Yeah,
so
they did.
What culpability do they have?
None, according to the Ninth Circuit, and the Supreme Court didn't reach it. But that was an argument that we made when I was in office, because it was frustrating, frankly, that we were putting these culverts in, which the federal government had approved and actually had funded in some cases. Look, again, the issue comes down not so much to whether the culverts get replaced as expensive that's going to be. And keep in mind that city and local governments, i.e. your local government you pay for with your taxes, they own four times as many culverts under roads that may impede fish passage as the state does. So this is a really big issue. But it's that legal issue, not that the treaties are enforceable, but what does that mean? What are the implications of that for sovereignty and control over decisions that could affect the number of fish?
Yeah. In fact, I was just talking to KOW reporter Joshua McNichols, who said, I really want to know what Rob McKenna thinks about this, because I'm working on a story about land use and water rights on the east side. And
I'm getting calls from local governments asking. Everyone's trying to figure it out.
Okay. We're all trying to figure it out.
But yep. Let's be clear. When we need to find $2 billion, we can find $2 billion if it's really important to certain people.
Well, you better find $10 billion because that's what it's going
to
be.
We can even find $10 billion when it's really important to certain interests. So once again, it's not just about the issue. It's about who has power in our society.
Former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna, Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter, all coming back with more Week in Review, the FBI report, and the World Cup, too. Stay tuned. Mike McGinn, Rob McGinn, and Joni Balter are discussing the week, and so are you on Twitter at KUOW as we live tweet the program. I'm Bill Radke. Moving on today, when President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, was Trump obstructing justice or legitimately firing an underling for poor performance? This week, the Justice Department released its internal review of how Comey handled, and the rest of the FBI handled, the Hillary Clinton email investigation. The FBI Director, the current one, Christopher Wray, says the investigation found that the FBI acted not out of an anti-Trump political bias, but on their assessment of facts, the law, and past department practice.
This report did not find any evidence of political bias or improper considerations actually impacting the investigation under review. The report does identify errors of judgment, violations of or even disregard for policy, and decisions that, at the very least, with the benefit of hindsight, were not the best choices.
Okay, so then was Trump firing Comey for allowing those errors of judgment, violations, disregard for policy, and poor choices? Or did he fire Comey because of the Russia investigation? Trump said today the report totally exonerates him.
I did nothing wrong. There was no collusion. There was no obstruction. The IG report yesterday went a long way to show that. And I think that the Mueller investigation has been totally discredited.
Laughter from my Week in Review panel.
Laughter at the dreaming that's going on there, because this report had actually nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. It's all about, and you know, look, James Comey, does everyone remember just feeling like it was weird when he came out the two times to talk about the email investigation? The announcements, to me, did seem out of order, and that's what this report is talking about.
This was Comey holding a news conference in the summer of 2016 to say he was recommending no charges against Hillary Clinton and also chastising her email practices. And then in October, right before the election, apparently over the objection of top Justice Department officials, Comey sent a letter to Congress, open letter, disclosing that the agents were scrutinizing new evidence in the Clinton case.
Yeah, and so I'll just continue here. Just when this report came out, not exonerating Trump in the Russia investigation, Comey was up on the New York Times with an op-ed very quickly. So he'd clearly been thinking about this and writing part of it. You can't write that fast. You just can't. And on all I could think of is this man is really thinking about his place in history here. He didn't even mind that they disagreed with his activities. But to me, you know, he's really worried about being the guy that gave us Donald Trump and wants to be careful how he talks about that.
Yeah, people felt like him saying that there's new evidence in the Hillary Clinton investigation through the election to Trump. Just very quickly, a former attorney general, because we have you here, I get to ask you quick things like this. When the Trump allies say that this calls into question the special counsel, the Robert Mueller investigation, do you agree with Joni that there's no basis in that, or is there some basis?
What this is about is that the president knows his biggest vulnerability now is obstruction of justice charges, and firing Comey could be a basis for an obstruction of justice charge, not necessarily a conviction, but you know, he did handle that in a very, very strange way. And the comments he made to Comey that Comey documented don't make it look very good. So what he is trying to do now is say there cannot be obstruction of justice because I fired Comey due to the fact he deserved to be fired. The challenge in that narrative, as Joni's already alluded, is that the information coming out in the IG report wasn't known to Trump when he made the decision to fire Comey.
Okay.
It's sort of after the fact. But nevertheless, it does probably help him try to stave off an obstruction of justice charge in connection with Comey's firing.
At least it does help him?
I think it makes it a little bit more problematic for Mueller, because what Trump is doing here, what President Trump is trying to accomplish, is similar strategically, and this is not a new idea, but the New York Times has been writing about this, to what the Clintons did to try to destroy Ken Starr and his investigation, to discredit him and his investigation.
Politically, is
yeah, because because look, let's remember what this is all really about. It's about impeachment. And it's not even is so much about impeachment as it is about conviction. Impeachment is just an indictment by the House acting as prosecutors. The Senate then has to convict by 2/3. So the Clintons knew that there was a risk of being impeached, but they needed to make sure that 2/3 of the Senate would not vote to convict and remove him from office. Trump is following the same playbook. You by attacking the investigation and attacking the investigator and attacking Comey, he seeks to discredit it and to make this such a political issue that members of the House, members of the Senate who are Republicans feel like they cannot come out against the president. So, with Clinton, it was the group that was initially called Censure and Move On. Remember that? Then they shortened it to Move On because they said the Clintons said we don't even have to put up with censure, even though there was a vote to move forward with that. I think it was like 432-2.
Okay.
So that's the background here.
Mike McGinn.
Well, I think we've seen a lot into, you know, the report lets us see human beings trying to figure out how do we deal with these really explosive issues of these investigations. And what we see is that they are indeed human beings who have to be really careful to not let their law enforcement work intrude into the political arena too much. At the end of the day, though, it was Hillary Clinton's emails and that investigation that was elevated and not the investigation of Trump. They made the wrong call. And, you know, and we are seeing the results.
By the way, it turns out one of the little nuggets in this report is that Comey used a private email account to conduct official FBI business while he supervised the investigation.
It was completely secure, except when Google was data mining all the emails on Gmail. Other than that, it was perfect.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
They were writing his emails for him back, you know, like they
exactly right. Yeah. Well, I wonder what ads he was being served. You know, so if you're writing emails about an investigation of an email server and Hillary Clinton, like what kind of ads do you suddenly get served as? Because, you know, whenever I go online, I'm looking for, you know, articles involving cameras, I immediately get a bunch of Nikon ads served to me. So it does raise the question.
Hillary Clinton's response on Twitter was three words, but my emails.
Yeah, yeah. Nice.
And her former campaign spokesperson said, I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
Well, there's a difference between an email server and using Gmail for some. I mean, look, you would be hard-pressed to find someone in government who doesn't give in to the temptation to use their personal email account for some government business. I mean,
You've done it yourself?
Never, not once. Okay. But you know, you walk around with two. I mean, I walked around like many people do. Mike, maybe you did two different phones.
Cell phones.
I literally had two cell phones. I did try to. But what do you do when you get an email that's mostly, you know, political and personal and appropriate for your personal phone, and then all of a sudden a government-related issue comes up? It's impossible to keep them completely separate.
I tell you, the technology is going to get everybody because, you know, as well, there were these texts in here that Donald Trump seized on that said, you know, we'll stop his election. And that's an example of how everybody uses these devices.
Yeah, these are a couple FBI agents showing themselves to be, is Trump going to get elected? No, we'll stop it.
So type nothing, use none of these devices. Remember that. Use the right one. All of that good stuff.
Let's roll right into our final topic because this hour's gone by fast. This week, the 2026 World Cup was awarded to a joint bid from that family of close allies, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, which means there's a chance that Seattle will host some World Cup matches. Should we wish for that, Joni?
I think World Cup is not, you know, is not a problem. It's a nice event that you have, and it doesn't sort of overwhelm you like something like the Olympics.
A Durkin spokesperson said it would cost about as much as a Super Bowl.
Oh. Well,
although it would also generate money through
it's supposed to nationally, would, or for all three countries. I think the economic impact is like $14 billion, which I find that's mind-blowing. I've never heard of I didn't realize how big the economic impact is from that one tournament.
Money generating.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably, Mike, you may know, I think it's probably a summation of all the economic effects of hosting the World Cup.
Well, that's got multipliers all over the place.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
Tons of multipliers.
Yeah, I know, and there's
those
substitution
things tend to be
effects.
Exaggerated. And if you're the person that actually has to balance the budget, you don't get, it doesn't show up in your revenue
Well, we're talking about this because Seattle is thought to, they're going to get one of the games, right? Or some of the games.
Might get one of the games,
it
not
might.
Like the big deal. But I did notice the mayor loved talking about soccer instead of
Can you blame her?
Other topics.
She's been doing a header every day this week. It hurts. Let's talk about soccer instead.
The King County executive, Dow Constantine, says if you're a citizen of the he didn't use these words. He made it sound like if you're a citizen of the world, you should want a World Cup in Soto.
So at a time when some parts of the nation and of Europe are seeking to become more insular, Seattle and King County is looking outward, is looking to the world, and we want the world to come here. to visit us here in 2026.
One possible argument against the match in Soto is that CenturyLink grass is fake. And FIFA, the soccer body, they like natural grass.
Well,
we should root for natural grass.
They say they can bring it in.
They put motocross in CenturyLink. I'm sure they can bring
in. They brought it in before, but it had sort of holes in it.
It has seams in between.
They have to work on it a little better and make it better.
We have 8 years to figure this out.
Do you want a scandal?
Do this.
That call should be reversed because the ball hit the seam. It hit a lump of dirt.
I trust these people to bring in the sod that is proper for this event.
Wouldn't be the biggest scandal to hit FIFA.
No.
No.
But is it weird for anyone else to imagine that in 8 years the big thing on our minds is going to be soccer matches? It's just sort of I guess it's a comforting thought.
Well, Seattle and Portland really are almost like European countries in how they approach soccer.
We have one of the highest average attendance numbers at our stadium of any, and in the world, not just in the United States.
We'll have
States,
hockey
right?
and basketball by then, so it'll really be, you know, we'll have so many different sports at that time.
Yeah. Can we talk about the Mariners?
I've been really good about this soccer stuff. They lost a one-run game. They're not even in first place in the AL West anymore.
That was poor Felix.
But, I don't even care. Know. Last night, I was at band practice, my rock and roll dad band. Whenever the guitarist would start working some part out, I sneak out my phone to see if the Mariners were going to get one run. I can't.
It's the first game
like
since
to watch
April
the
that we were limited to
on
one
the,
run.
On the phone with the little things moving
I
along.
Think, yeah.
Well, I can see the pitch.
These Mariners are real, you know. They seem
the Canadian,
better than we've ever seen.
The Canadians are going to save
us. Brew.
Paxton is pitching tonight.
It's a mirage.
There you go.
Rob McKenna, Mike McGinn, Joni Balter, thanks for being my Week in Review panel.
Thank you.
Rob McKenna, former state attorney general, partner at Orrick, Herrington, and Sutcliffe. Mike McGinn, former mayor of Seattle. Joni Balter, civic cocktail host on the Seattle Channel. Let's do it again soon, right?
Thank you, Bill.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for listening, all.